and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the third week of May 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hi, Elise.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott from the Tribune and KUT News.
Hello.
Today we're talking the latest in the state budget crisis, other Democrats labeling Bill White as a quote-unquote nerd, and much ado about the governor and first lady's rental home. We'll start with Ben and Ross on the latest in the crisis.
Well, so this week we had the big three, Governor Perry, Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst, and Speaker Joe Strauss, come up with their official list of the cuts for the 2010 budget. These are the 5% cuts that they asked all agencies to turn in to help lessen what they're going to have to try and figure out for the supplemental when they get back in 2011.
What so, Ben's trying to say here.
So they had they proposed the 5% cuts would be about $1.8 billion. What they ended up cutting was about $1.2 billion.
Which Jim Dunham, House Democratic leader Jim Dunham, then
right,
brought up.
Jumped on, saying that it was exactly what we could have taken for race to the top funds and for unemployment insurance stimulus money.
555 plus 700 million. 1.
So what's 2. In the one? So these are all really interesting numbers, but what are they cutting?
Well, it's what they're.
Ha, I've trapped you.
No, they really announced, to some degree, they announced more prominently what they were not cutting,
right.
What they had exempted.
Right.
And what, if you look at some of these cuts, like I looked, went to the LBB's Legislative Budget Board's website, and you look at what, like, the Department of Justice, Criminal Justice proposed in its cuts, you look at what they ended up then cutting, it's a lot of stuff like they're replacing state money with some of their own revenue, they're replacing state money with federal revenue, they're delaying fixing things or buying new equipment. So it's one-time fixes that are not exactly cuts.
These are the kind of cuts you do in the accounting department and not the kind of cuts you do in operations, right?
And even, so two things that I thought were interesting. So I talked to, you know, conservative budget person and a progressive, we don't use the L word, right? Anyway, budget person. and they...
You got a wingtip from either side, right?
Yes. The conservative budget person said, well, first of all, it's nice that they gave some of these exemptions. They gave about half a billion.
And let's just say it's hospital beds.
Yep.
It's Homeland Security.
It's closing
it's
prisons.
Public safety. It's workforce Border development. Team. And it's financial aid for universities. Those are the five big areas they cited that they had exempted from the proposed cuts.
And right. The person I talked to said, you know, that's all great, but when they come back in 2011, they're going to have to cut those. So it's nice that they said, no, we're not going to cut it this time, but they're going to have to do it next time. Talking to the on the other side, the person said, look, they went looking for $1.8 billion, and it was so hard to come up with $1.8 billion that they only got $1.2. What in the world are they going to do when they need to cut 18?
Well, the other trick here is that they're cutting the budget that we're in. And when we talk about the budget shortfall, the $11 to $18 billion that you hear people talk about, we're talking about the next budget. So if you cut the size of the budget we're in, that serves to some extent as the base budget for the next budget they draw. So if you can cut this one down, then the difference from here to there is shorter.
Yes, but the need is no different.
The need is no different. And in fact, most of the money in the Texas state budget is in programs that are politically very, very difficult or even impossible to cut. And that's really where this comes down to, you know, being a hard problem. Now, you know, we've got all these people, you know, if you sort of add this to what we had last week, you know, we don't want gambling. You know, the lieutenant governor and the governor both said no to gambling. The speaker,
no new taxes.
The speaker whose family is involved in gambling has said, you know, I'm not even going to talk about gambling. So that's sort of in limbo land. We've got we expect $9 to $10 billion in the state's rainy day fund, which is basically a big savings account, and some lawmakers are loath to spend all of that.
In fact, I haven't heard anybody say, sort of out front, yes, I want all the rainy day funds to be applied to the shortfall. Jim, no one's said right. Right?
Last week,
right.
Jim Pitts, House Appropriations Chair, said that he thinks just. Off the top of his head, he thinks he has votes for half of the rainy day fund.
And Kirk Watson said today in Trib Live, we'll talk about Watson in a second, no rainy day funds, he said.
Right, right. No. So, well, he said no rainy day funds. It's
and,
interesting.
No and no taxes.
No rainy day funds and no taxes until we have really gone back and taken this budget sort of down to its bones, figured out what we're really going to do, and, you know, which is an interesting line. I mean, you know, whenever you get in a budget crisis, somebody picks up this line, and it's often the people who've been in economic development, as he has, or in business. You know, back in the day, Bill Clements did this and came in and said, we're going to zero-based budgeting. We're going to go from the ground up and rebuild this budget. You know, the problem is that the state government, I mean, this is, you know, it doesn't matter which side of the political spectrum you're on, where you are. The state government promises to do more, promises us as voters that it will do more than it is willing to pay to do. And so you get into these binds all the time where they can't raise the money to pay for the things they promise. And so you either have to cut away at the things they promise or come up with more money than is politically feasible.
Look, I want somebody who we query, who we question, one of us or all of us over time, to answer the damn question, how are you going to do it? They all like to tell you the things they're not going to do. I will not raise taxes. I will not drain the rainy day fund.
Right.
What are you going to do?
That old line, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Nobody wants to die. Well, somebody has to die now. Right. Because it is a math problem. It's a math problem. If you will not raise taxes, if you will not drain the rainy day fund, if you don't want to savage state agencies, which is what would be required in the absence of new revenue, if you don't want gambling, what are you going to do? Somebody please die.
I think it's a math problem, though.
Somebody please die podcast.
Yeah, math problems are pretty easy, though. And the real problem here is that it's a political problem. You know, the math problem, you can say, well, you know, subtract from that and add to that and make the numbers balance. The political problem is, I'm going to either kill that program, which is popular with these people, or I'm going to kill this program, which is popular with those people. And then you have to do all those calculations 181 times, because that's how many legislators
there are. But now I'm suddenly sympathetic to the people who elected Rand Paul last night in Kentucky. If you guys won't do it, get out of the way. Let somebody else do it.
I think that the politicians on the fringes of both parties will give you the straight answer. I mean, I know that there are Republicans who will say, you're right. No new taxes, no rainy day fund. And yeah, I want to ravage the state budget. I want to cut away things that I don't think we need to pay for anymore.
Right. But if you assume that 5% of the state agency's budgets gets you, even optimistically, $2 billion over the biennium, and you got to get $18 billion in the worst case out, $2 billion or 5% at a time, that's math I can do.
Well, that's
9 times 5% is, oh my God, is what it is.
That's right. When you sunset TxDOT. Right? That saves a lot of money.
I mean, that's just crazy. That's when you privatize everything. It's nuts.
This math problem actually segs well into Evan's topic, which is Bill White liking to read spreadsheets at night because he finds it relaxing, and Kirk Watson on Wednesday calling the Democratic gubernatorial candidate
a nerd, and he meant it in a nice possible way.
Finally,
nice
use for the iPad. Read spreadsheets at night.
Look. We said all along this was going to be an election in which boring was the new exciting. Boy, we didn't know how right we were. I asked Attorney General, what should I call him? Senator Watson.
Senator.
Suddenly, I'm having a Philpott moment.
I think he won't call you back.
My facts are suddenly out of my grasp. I asked Senator Watson this morning at Trib Live, and he was let's just acknowledge, funniest guest so far, very engaging.
Right.
Busted on himself a little bit, too. He was good. He
successfully dodged a number of questions.
Amazing. Know. Well, when you're that small, it's easier to avoid which he would say himself. I asked him about the Rasmussen poll that came out earlier this week that had Perry up 51-38 on White, and his response was basically, I don't believe that poll. There were these other polls that showed it closer. I think this poll's an outlier. And I pointed out to Senator Watson that the same polling company did the other polls, and they liked those polls, but they didn't like this poll. Don't understand exactly how that works. But he said, look, I think Bill White's going to win. He's my guy. And the reason is, he said, the White campaign, I don't know how they're going to feel about this, but Bill White is a nerd. That's what he said. And that is his argument for why he thinks Bill White can beat Rick Perry. His view is, Rick Perry is a show horse. I'm paraphrasing here.
Right.
Rick Perry is a show horse. Bill White is a workhorse. What the state needs is a workhorse. What the state needs now is less good hair and less white pearly teeth and, you know, less handsome and dynamic and charismatic and more get down to work.
This is the blind date personality argument, right?
Right.
Right. You know, Bill White has a good personality.
Yeah. Well, this is also the, or another way to think of it is Bill White is everybody's first husband, and Rick Perry is everybody's second husband. And so are you choosing the first husband or the second husband to be governor of the state?
Wait, or is it the other way around?
Have I gotten that wrong?
Yes. First husband is more attractive, right?
I don't know. No, I thought they all go to seed at a certain point. I don't remember. Anyway, we'll just edit this part out. The point is...
Go back to that part about you have to die.
Mayor Watson, Senator Watson, Kirk Watson's point this morning was that Bill White's a nerd, and that speaks well for Bill White and would speak well for Texas. And my question to all of you is, does the state want to elect a nerd? Right? Or does anybody in politics want to elect a nerd? We're electing people in whom we see ourselves, our ideals, our hopes, and often the person who represents those things, who embodies those things, is somebody large personality, dynamic. I mean, I this is not a knock on White. I'm just putting the question out there. Does being labeled a nerd help or hurt him?
So they say television killed the political discourse in the second half of the 20th century. And I think one of the...
Podcasts are killing it right this minute, right. Actually.
So one of the reasons why is because politicians kind of had to be more like celebrities, and politics had to be more like a popularity contest. So since we view our politicians through these kind of manufactured lenses now, through television, through media, through these, you know, personalized videos that Perry puts out, his charisma sells, and voters kind of are drawn to people who are more substance, or more style and less substance. You know, back in the day when we had unattractive presidents, or presidents who, you know, were nerdy but didn't actually get presented that way.
Who's she calling ugly?
Well, like William Henry Harrison,
Taft,
I mean, apparently, and
Calvin Coolidge was not hot. I feel like it's kind of a product of our
there's,
time.
There's your headline: Hugh: Calvin Coolidge was not hot.
There's always been a medium or a channel for populism. I mean, we had Huey Long back in the day before there were TV cameras. I mean, there's always been this appeal. Sometimes you want a populist and sometimes you want a mechanic. And what Watson's betting here is that we want a mechanic. We want a nerd. We want somebody who goes in and reads spreadsheets all night.
Does the state have the capacity to embrace a nerd?
And my argument is that in today's politics, my argument is, I guess, like that in today's politics, we're already so far away from being able to embrace nerds. You know, we're already kind of, our minds and our paradigms are at a place where it's like, I'm going to vote for the taller, more attractive, more charismatic candidate.
Well, how do you explain the United States Senate based on that sentence?
Incumbency.
Okay, yeah, they've all been in office since before TV was invented, I believe.
Shame on us, by the way, for being in a world in which that's the case. I don't necessarily dispute that it's the case. I will say absolutely. I think it's disgusting that we elect, you know, hotties.
Right. Well, Scott Brown is very attractive.
We elect the people with the best rhetoric. And, you know, people are now saying, well, we want different. We want it different. We want a change in Washington. We want a change in our state. But it's simply the rhetoric that's changing. I mean, you hear people screaming different arguments, but it's still screaming and not presenting facts and spreadsheets, I guess. So,
well, you do what your audience responds to.
Right.
And this is what the audience responds to. And, you know, at some level, you know, I sort of have this sort of contrarian view of this. I mean, you know, I think most of the time this is sort of a show for people. But when it really matters, voters tend to step up. I mean, when they get into a box and they really need somebody to solve a particular problem, whatever they think the problem is and whoever they think the solution is, they do tend to step up. And, you know, I think one of the things that's going on right now is people are, I mean, just generally in politics, is people are really frustrated with the political atmosphere and the economy. And they're sort of in the, you know, let's strike out mode. Let's just, you know, I mean, you know, what we saw yesterday in the elections around the country was, you know, incumbency is not a very comfortable thing right now. And I think the voters are just kind of lashing out.
Well, let me offer one other thing about that, which we're not necessarily here to talk about yesterday's elections. But I think that what is being interpreted as we don't like the establishment, and that's how you explain Rand Paul, and that's how you explain Spector losing, I might actually look at a slightly different way, which is we don't like fakies. We don't like fake Republicans. We want a real Republican. And they view Rand Paul as being more pure in conservative terms. And we want to elect, in the words of Howard Dean, somebody from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party to be the nominee in Pennsylvania, not a fake Republican, which they perceive are all expected to be. I know people are calling this about the establishment, but I'm not sure it's not about purity.
Uh-huh. Well, and speaking of Rand Paul, I do think that being a nerd can work in smaller quarters.
Guy's a nerd.
Well,
right?
and
sure.
And his dad. I mean, you know, you have not seen a really great campaign rally until you've seen Ron Paul get his supporters up in a fever pitch when he talks about the gold standard.
Right.
I mean, yeah. They go crazy when he starts talking about the gold standard. Yeah. So it works. So
William Jennings Paul, there you go.
That's exactly right.
Well, I guess this actually does kind of go to this, as we talk about being a pure Republican, this does kind of flow into my topic, because Governor Perry is facing a series of stories after the Associated Press wrote this week.
Let's give Jay Root props. A great story.
The Associated Press's Jay Root wrote this week that he took a closer look at the money spent by the governor, the taxpayer money spent by the governor on his rental home. So in the fall of 2007, the governor and the first lady moved out so that the governor's mansion that was not burned down at the time, because it needed to be renovated. So they moved out and started living in this home.
I forgot that. They were not living there when mm-hmm. the fire happened.
Right. It was being renovated. That's why the furniture didn't burn.
Right. So it was $9,900 a month, still is $9,900 a month rent that taxpayers foot the bill for. Root goes through and finds kind of more interesting details about what they're spending. For instance, $70 subscription to Food and Wine magazine.
Why is the state of Texas paying for the governor and his wife to receive Food and Wine magazine?
Well, I want to know why they need two chefs.
Well,
but I guess
the Food and Wine tweeted this, right? Didn't the
Food and Wine people are sort of like, you know, attracted, repulsed. On the one hand, all circulation these days is good circulation.
Our name and lights, right, yeah.
Right. On the other hand.
So the question, I guess, for me is the political question, whether this, if politics is all symbolism, whether this is a chink in his armor that White can exploit, because the Democrats are certainly trying to. They are going to, or by the time this podcast airs, they have pulled out a double-wide trailer and put it at 11th and Congress downtown and are offering it to Governor Perry to live in for $1 a day.
And remember, this goes back to when Mike Huckabee was governor of Arkansas and the renovation of the Arkansas governor's mansion was happening. He and Mrs. Huckabee decided to live in literally
a double-wide
trailer on the grounds of the mansion, costing the taxpayers
zero.
Propane, I mean, you know, what?
Yeah, right. Propane
electricity.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a danger in politics of doing something offensive that's understandable, as opposed to doing something offensive that everybody kind of goes, oh, those are big numbers, I don't really understand that. So you can do something in politics, and I won't put any names on it, but just, you know, make up something. You know, you wasted $2 billion on this program consolidating these agencies and doing blah, 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 blah. Oftentimes, voters won't hold you directly and personally responsible for that. But if you just spend one public dollar on your gym, they get that. And they go, wait a minute, that's a waste of money. That's $38 a month. And sometimes the more understandable thing becomes a symbol for the other stuff. Now, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that that's what is going to happen to Perry here, but that's the danger of this kind of story.
So that the Democrats or opponents of Perry's, let's leave the party out of it, can say, you know, this is a terrible economy and the state's got an $18 billion shortfall. An old monocle rich guy McGee out there is living fat on the land, and you know, the symbolism of that is just out of sync.
I feel like it probably would have been in better shape if taxpayers were buying Field and Stream rather than Food and Wine.
Oh, that's it. Or Garden
because
and Gun.
Because it's elitist.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Or how's it about Coyote and Gun Belt magazine.
The secret life of governors, right?
Yeah, because in the scheme of things, I mean, $10,000 a month for rent, in the scheme of the $154 billion biennial budget, is not that much money.
But you can wrap your head around it. I think you can wrap your head around rent and an expensive rent and a waste of money more than, I mean, I don't even understand when you consolidate agencies. So how is...
Yeah, we heard that rundown you gave of the budget.
Oh, Lord almighty.
Zing. But if you think about it, what a lot of people might say is, I understand that the governor has specific needs. He's the governor. There are security needs. There are other issues that relate to, I mean, we all get that, public safety. But couldn't you take it a place for $5,000 a month, for $6,000 a month?
Well, you know, the news of the rent.
I don't pretend to know the answer to that. I'm just saying it's a question that people could be asking, and if they're asking a question, that's bad.
The news of the rent thing has been out for a while. This was, you know, this story was interesting because it detailed the expenses that, you know, that they've incurred both on the state dime and on his campaign dime. I mean, you know, they do campaign events and all that, just like they do at the mansion, and that's paid for out of campaign funds, and, you know, they're careful about their accounting and everything. But in the details, you actually see something about these people that, you know, it's not just an abstract number. It's a subscription to Food and Wine magazine. It's a tangible, understandable thing.
But I want to come back to
why political danger in that.
Why I want to ask the question again: why should the state of Texas be paying for magazine subscriptions?
That's why it's a problem.
I mean, I don't know. I can't fathom why. And that one, particularly that one. Mm-hmm. What does that have to do with anything?
And that's right. Precisely what Food and Wine tweeted. They said, you know, we're happy that the governor subscribes to us, well, but we don't want them using.
You know, the Manchin has.
You could argue Texas Monthly.
The real Manchin. Oh, really?
I'm just saying. Okay. That one he can have.
$170 for 2 years.
I suspect
years,
he's comped.
You know, they've got two chefs at the Manchin. They've got a chef and a part-time chef. They do all these big dinners and everything. Maybe the chef's reading Food and Wine. I don't know. But, I mean, it's just, it's the kind of detail that is sticky and voters look at. I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong that they're taking Food and Wine magazine. They may have a perfectly legitimate reason. But, but it's an understandable thing.
Right.
And when you're looking at a budget and you're saying we need to cut 5%, and we're talking about employee cutbacks and cutbacks in, you know, employee benefits, employee health insurance, and all of this kind of stuff, where the big money is in the state budget.
Right.
And you're taking Food and Wine? It just looks wrong.
Did who put the trailer on the? Was it
that? That would be the AFL-CIO, the labor group.
Couldn't have been the State Democratic Party.
Couldn't have been.
That would have required their act to be together. That sounds like an Andy Brown joint to me. But you're saying it's actually.
They've got this funny bit. AFL-CIO. If you don't know your way around Austin, is catty corner from
the real governor's mansion.
And so they're like, you know, we feel bad that the mansion burned down. We feel like you ought to have a place to stay, and so they pulled this trailer.
Well, that's like their after theater place in town.
Right.
So they don't have to drive out to Barton Creek. It's like their little Pieta trailer or whatever it actually ends up being. So,
and just one quick note with the last few minutes that we have, though. I should make the point that on the flip side, Perry's team is coming out this week basically bashing White on White not promising to keep taxes at where they are. Because he basically pledged to us during Trib Live saying that he didn't want to
I'm going to get my SAG card being in the Perry's web video,
right.
You know, Perry campaign's web video.
And so on one side we have elitist Perry and Food and Wine magazine. On the other side we have Bill will raise your taxes, liberal trial lawyer White. You know, so
couldn't White's campaign simply put out an email and said, well, we wouldn't have to if he weren't spending X number on his rent.
Zing.
Then Phil Potts' next career. Here we go.
Day 67, Governor Anthony Bourdain holed up in his kitchen reading cookbooks.
Right. So is what I guess, you know, if politics can be these messages can be fit onto bumper stickers and we can say, you know, one bumper sticker can be I don't have two chefs. The other one is, you know, Bill White will raise your taxes. So is this basically, you know, all even now.
Let them eat bouillabaisse on one, and
it is lowering the conversation to the place that we deserve. I'm afraid that's what it is.
It's very early. I mean, you know, a lot of what candidates do at this time of year, you know, the main thing that they're doing is we're in the middle of the financial primaries. They're raising money, and they're trying to keep their profiles up high enough that the people from whom they're trying to raise money. You know, see that they're out doing something. And, you know, this isn't a time of when politics is like automatically on the front page or at the top of newscasts. And so they have to do sort of kooky stuff to get into the papers and on TV and stuff. And this is what we see this time of year. It's kind of kooky stuff.
This is a good time to practice, too. I mean, you throw everything.
See what works.
You throw everything, see what sticks to the wall, and nobody's going to remember that you put out an email that everyone ignored. Now, a month before the election,
right.
If all of a sudden you put something out and everybody goes, yeah, that's kind of stupid, then that's a problem.
By the time people start paying attention,
yeah, right.
You will have had your act together.
Theoretically.
Yeah.
All right. If you have any comments or questions for the Tribcast, you can email us at podcasts@texastribune.org. Check in with the Trib to actually see some video of that double wide. And on behalf of Evan, Ross, and Ben, I'm Elise. Thank you for listening.